I didn't have any money, so I had no choice. If I wanted to be in this business, I had to find a way to do it. There were books out there that said that you can invest in real estate without any of your own money. And I thought, well, that's a great idea because I don't have any of my own money. So where do I get this other people's money, as they called it? And one of the ways was just to raise money from investors.
Hey guys, David Robinson here. Welcome to the Lead Sponsor Podcast. As usual, another great episode for you today. Incredibly honored to have a guest come on the show today who has 30 years of real estate investing experience. This individual has acquired over $800 million worth of real estate, including 700 single-family homes and 4,000 multifamily units. He started out in the fix and flip space, transitioned into multifamily, and has built a phenomenal business over the years. He's also the author of The Hands-Off Investor, an insider's guide to investing in passive real estate syndications. He's also a frequent public speaker at many different real estate conferences and events nationwide. And I'm honored to have Mr. Brian Burke with us on the show today. Well, Brian, welcome to the show. I appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us today.
Well, thanks for having me here.
So generally, we like to get a little bit of a background on our guests, and you have a tremendous amount of experience in the real estate syndication space as a lead sponsor. And so if you don't mind, let's just talk about your background. What were you doing before you got into the space, and how did you get involved in this world of real estate investing?
Well, after I first got into real estate, I was, had to pay my bills. So I was working my W-2 job. I was in law enforcement, and I worked, evenings and weekends really, cause I was on swing shifts. So during the daytime, I was doing my real estate investment business. I was flipping houses. And then eventually I started building houses. And it got to the point where my house flipping and building business was producing enough revenue that my job was getting in the way. So about 20 years ago, maybe 21 years ago, I hung up the W-2 job and went, all in my real estate business, and still just mostly house flipping. But then I decided that it was time to step up my game a little bit. I had done all my house flipping basically on like a syndication model. I created a blind pool fund, and I used the money in the blind pool fund to fund all my acquisitions and renovations. So it was time to take that skill set and step up my game a little bit and amp it up into larger projects. And I got into multifamily about 20 years ago and, kind of just been growing it from there.
So I've got to ask, you exited sort of your law enforcement job over 20 years ago. I think you mentioned 21, 22 years ago, went full-time into the flipping business, and you structured things through more of like a quote unquote syndication model, which, obviously in the last 10 years or so has gained a lot of traction, but back then, probably not something that was heavily taught or known by traditional real estate investors who were doing fix and flips. So how were you even exposed to that world of pooling money, creating a fund, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I didn't have any money, so I had no choice. If I wanted to be in this business, I had to find a way to do it. And of course, there's a lot of books out there. There were at the time, 20 years ago, the books probably weren't as good as they are now, but there were books out there that said that you can invest in real estate without any of your own money. And I thought, well, that's a great idea because I don't have any of my own money. So where do I get this other people's money, as they called it? And, one of the ways was just to raise money from investors. And so I called a local attorney and I said, hey, I want to raise money from investors to buy real estate. How do I do that? And he's like, well, there's a lot of legal framework around it. So come in and we'll discuss it. And just had a meeting with the lawyer, and he showed me how to set it up, told me what we needed to do to set it up. And I had him write it all up, and that's what we did.
Okay, great. Well, it's a pretty simple process. So it sounds like when you exited the W-2 job, went full-time into the flipping business, it wasn't very long before you said, hey, I actually like this multifamily space a little bit better than the fix and flip. Help walk us through that process for you, this transition into the multifamily space.
It was kind of a two-stage transition. The first stage was when I was buying single families to flip, I decided at some point that it would be smart to like buy a house a year to keep. And so I started went on this program of like, you know, flip one, keep one, flip one, keep one. And so I had accumulated a couple of houses and I decided that, you know, I could get a little bit more economy of scale if I could buy multi-units. And so I sold two of the houses that I had and did a 1031 exchange into a apartment complex. And that was my first foray into multifamily investing. And then the next thing I did was, you know, after flipping and kind of like doing some personal multifamily investing on the side, but still flipping for another, you know, 10 years, I decided, okay, now it's, I guess it wasn't 10 years, maybe it was about 5 years, is really time to amp up multi, because it just seemed like a great way to expand the business outside of my home state. It didn't make a lot of sense to buy rental property in California, even back then. And I'm located in California and felt like if I'm going to go all the way to, you know, Texas or some other place, it, I don't want to do it for a single family house. It's just too much work and not enough scale. So that kind of led me back to multi and focusing on expanding that segment of the business.
And so roughly what you, just for context, roughly what year was that when you decided, hey, I'm going to go, you know, pretty heavy into commercial multifamily and expand outside of my backyard?
It was about 08, 07, 08 is when I started the journey. And then, of course, you know, the real estate was in kind of some chaos and turmoil. And so I was watching how that was playing out and trying to figure out how to navigate that without getting hurt. So we, I decided that I would just kind of watch and wait for a little while. And, you know, even though I was underwriting deals and looking at stuff, I didn't buy anything until 08. And the first like larger multifamily property I bought was a 60 unit deal that I paid half of what the last guy had paid. And I thought, you know, now was the time. It turned out I was still too early. And that, that goes in the record books as one of my worst deals ever.
Interesting.
But you know, it's, I guess, it's better to be maybe, a minute too late than just a minute too early. But I would have rather have been about 10 minutes too late, 'cause I would have actually been right on time.
And so how long did you hold that 60 unit deal?
I think it took
me, you back away. So
yeah, it took me like 7 years to get out of that thing. It was a horrible experience. And, you know, even though I had paid half what the last guy did, you know, the economy just completely tanked in 08 or 09. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you had people losing jobs and couldn't pay rent. And it was just an absolute utter nightmare. And so it took a long time of holding that thing before it was worth enough more than I paid for it to make it worthwhile to sell.
And, you know, we'll get into more of sort of your outlook on what's happening in the market right now. But just because we're on the topic of this 60 unit, which was back in the previous recession. So you bought it, to your point, maybe a little bit early, and then you had to just wade through the next 7 years. What will you do different through this next recession, based upon that experience that you had with the 60 unit?
Well, the main thing I do different is I buy a lot higher quality property that was built in 1965 or something like that. I don't do 60s and 70s construction anymore. And I don't do C-class multifamily anymore. That was a C property. You know, we're in like the A- to B+ segment right now, which is a little bit more resilient. We also finance differently. You know, this was back in my, you know, everything's got to be 100% finance days, right? So I actually was able to find a way to 100% finance the acquisition of that property. And, you know, in retrospect, you know, carrying too much of a debt load is a death sentence. You know, when the market's going down, it'll kill you. And that's exactly what happened. I ended up servicing the mortgage on that property out of my own pocket for like 4 years to the tune of $15,000 a month. I mean, that was a very painful learning experience. I got all my money back eventually, but you know, still, it was a very painful experience while I was living through it. And it's an experience I don't intend to ever repeat. So, you know, now when we're buying the properties that we're buying nowadays, you know, we're coming in at 65% loan to value ratios, maybe 70, maybe we top out at 75%. But, you know, we're not doing any more high leverage deals. That was way back in the early days of my rookie mistake phase of my career.
Well, and this is great. I mean, being willing to share some of the early mistakes and learning experiences that will help our listeners become better investors. I'm curious, do you remember what happened with rent rates? What was the biggest challenge? Was it the fact that Occupancy dropped as people were losing jobs. What were the biggest challenges that you faced with that particular property?
There were two primary changes, and kind of my joke goes along the line of half the units are empty and the other half aren't paying. And so what that breaks down to is occupancy and bad debt. And so it was a massive problem with people, you know, not being able to afford to pay. And so then they either skipped and always skipped with thousands of dollars in unpaid rent, or you had to evict them, or, you know, and then you couldn't find a qualified resident to replace them. And then the ones that you did get in there would pay for a month or two and then stop paying. And so it was a nightmare. And, you know, that's kind of the life of C-class property in a recession. These are the people, you know, some people like to say, oh, always buy C-class because it's recession resistant. Well, that's the biggest BS line, obviously, from somebody who's never been through a recession with C-class property, because it doesn't work that way. They're the first people to get hit, and or actually they might be the last people to get hit, but when they get hit the hardest, and they have the least ability to recover.
And, you know, a lot of people that are investing in C-class would argue, hey, you know, A-class is going to move to B-class, B-class to C-class as income levels drop. Did you see that play out?
Not in the least.
In your building?
No, nobody that lives in a nice apartment is moving into a C-class apartment. They're going to go get a roommate in their B-class apartment and stay where they're at. No, we did not see that happen at all. Instead, what happens is your D-class apartment people see your half-empty C-class that you're offering 2 weeks of free rent, and they find a way to finagle their way into that and then stop paying. And so you end up with actually a worse tenant base.
Great insights. So let's put aside the past and the pain of the past, and let's talk about what you've done. I mentioned in the intro that you guys have acquired over $800 million worth of real estate over a 30-year span, you know, some of that being single family. You've acquired 700 single family homes, but 4,000 multifamily units. And so you guys have done an incredible job over at Praxis. I'm curious if you could just describe for us what your business looks like today from a structure standpoint, a personnel standpoint, and then focus.
Yeah, well, it's looking different today than it even looked 6 months ago, because you know, the market's in a state of transition. So our portfolio as of the beginning of 2021 was around 3,000-ish units, and we've sold about 2,500 units in the last year and a half. So, you know, I saw kind of a bit of a market top out happening, and we took the opportunity to start exiting, and we've been massive net sellers. You know, we didn't really want to be net sellers in as much as that we still wanted to buy real estate because we believed in the underlying fundamentals of the market, but the prices were just getting ridiculously high, and that made it nearly impossible to buy anything because, you know, we're pretty disciplined buyers, but it sure made it easy to sell stuff for some incredible prices and some tremendous jumps and even stuff we'd owned a very short time. So that's been pretty interesting. So now we're sitting here with, you know, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 units, which is the smallest we've been in a lot of years. But we're still looking to acquire, but still not yet finding, because you know, I think the market still has a little bit more down to move, and we're waiting for that to happen before we strike. So, you know, in terms of size, there's actually not that many people here. There's only about six of us is about all it takes on the you know, on the Praxis Capital side, and then on the property management side, of course, we're vertically integrated. So we have our own property management company. We manage our own assets. That side of the business ebbs and flows, you know, as our portfolio size grows and shrinks. So we've been as high as 50 or 60 employees and as low as about, you know, 15 or 20. And I think we're probably on the low side of that right now.
Just as a side note, I'm curious, of the assets that you sold, did you retain any of the property management for those assets?
No, we don't have any interest in doing third-party fee-based management. We only manage our own assets.
Understandable. Okay, so as six individuals, let's talk about like the early days of you really building up Praxis. Like, how did this sort of evolve over time when you got serious about formalizing a business entity and structure and a business model? How did that evolve over time?
Well, just slowly, you know, you recognize, oh, we have a need for to do this, and then we did it. And then all of a sudden you look back and you're like, wow, how did we get from here to there? You know, it's interesting. Some people, you know, they have a plan and they map out exactly what roles they need to fill, and they have an org chart and all that other stuff. I didn't do anything that formal. You know, we just kind of grew it as we saw what our needs were. And we had a big spurt of growth in 2009 when in the heat of the real estate collapse. It was probably our period of largest growth. And at that time, we were buying houses on the courthouse steps at foreclosure auctions. And we were, you know, sometimes buying two or three houses a day even. And you know, for that, we, you know, we had our own construction arm. So, you know, we just started hiring for roles. And, you know, we hired, one of our early hires was an investor relations person. And then, you know, so we could raise more money to, you know, grow and buy more. You know, we hired a manager of construction and just, you know, all sorts of different roles as we saw that we needed them. And then when the foreclosure stuff was starting to trail off, we had to wind up some of that stuff. You know, we didn't need as many auction buyers and construction people, but we always retained the investor relations person. And so that's when we started shifting to large multifamily syndications, you know, at a much greater rate. And the team that we had already built for our house flipping side was right there to jump in and help us start creating what we have now.
And as I just sort of browsed over your business before our call today, it seems like you have some, you know, partners or executives in your business that have quite a large array of experience, even in multifamily. How did you attract people to your business at that point in time, especially very experienced individuals?
Well, it's funny. You're going to hate this story. I didn't. It was weird. When I was doing my house flipping stuff, I was working with a real estate broker who was helping to, you know, sell the properties. And he had an assistant that worked there that helped with all of my stuff. And he would go look at the property before the auction. And if we get it at the auction, he would kind of help coordinate, you know, getting somebody out there to fix it up. And was just kind of just a really helpful guy. Well, he one day quit his job and got a job working for some multifamily operator, and then ultimately ended up quitting that job and through a series of career moves became chief operating officer and later chief executive officer of a big real estate REIT. And through various relationships, I think it was like not brownies, but you know, like where girls get together and have like camp outs and stuff like that.
Sure.
Well, there was another guy in his daughter's camp out thing that was also in real estate private equity and was looking for a career change to be more entrepreneurial instead of working for the man. And he said, I got two other guys that are kind of loose competitors of mine that are kind of in the same situation. And we all want to like create, you know, kind of do our own thing and kind of create something. And the guy that used to work with my real estate agent said, I know this guy that's in this business. You guys need to talk to him. So lo and behold, one day I get a cold call from one of these guys who's like, look, me and my two other friends, we want to, you know, we've got like 100,000 units of experience, but, you know, we can't raise any money. So, you know, my friend said I should call you. And through a series of about 6 months of conversations, I got them to join Praxis, and instantly I had a national footprint with 100,000 units of experience. So it was it's just you never know how the most seemingly like innocent relationship could later turn out to be the biggest spark that lights, you know, an incredible fuse for your business. So, you know, you can never discount any relationship as being meaningless.
And this may be a question that's difficult to answer, but I'm curious if you feel like you would have figured out a way to grow at the level you grew to had that opportunity not presented itself. Like, was that your vision before you were introduced to these individuals and ultimately formalized a business model? Was that sort of what you saw in mind moving forward?
It was exactly what I was trying to do, and it was exactly what they were trying to do. And together we were able to do it, but apart we weren't. You know, they had tried and failed with another guy to try to make this work, and the other guy couldn't perform, and, you know, that it didn't work out for them. And then I had tried, I'd been primarily up to that point, I had been buying entirely in Texas, and I was pretty geographically constrained there because I had a partner that was there, and, you know, he was kind of like, he was a home builder, but on the side, he was, you know, we were doing the apartments together, and it worked out great. I mean, we had a lot of success. We bought, you know, 1,000 or something units together, but I couldn't get out of Texas. And so, you know, I wanted to buy in, you know, Atlanta and Florida and Arizona. But I would call brokers there and they'd be like, you know, who the hell are you? You know, we don't know you, and you've never done a deal here, so you're nothing. And so I just couldn't make it work, you know, and I didn't have anybody to go look at the properties, and, you know, and that would have meant that I would have been on planes all the time, which wasn't really the life I wanted to live. So, you know, when I had the opportunity to have these guys come on board, just instantly we had credibility because, you know, through their, you know, experience, they had, I think it was like 11,000 units of Atlanta multifamily experience. So now when I'd call a broker about a deal in Atlanta, it's like, yeah, we've done 11,000 units in Atlanta. It's like, oh, great. You know, can I send you a package? Yeah, the conversation changed dramatically. And so, you know, that really made a big difference.
So what have you, let's talk over the last, let's call it 4 years, 5 years, what have you focused on from a geographic perspective, as well as an asset type perspective? And has that evolved over the last roughly 5 years or so?
Well, from a geographic perspective, we're looking at markets that have massive population in migration, as well as job growth and income growth. And so that's centered us primarily in the southeastern U.S. You know, I think from Texas to Florida and north to Tennessee, that whole square, we've been interested in pretty much every major metro in that square. We've owned in Texas, Georgia, Alabama, and Florida, and we've certainly been looking in a lot of other markets in southeastern states. We also have an interest in Arizona and Nevada, we do own in Arizona as well.
Gotcha. That was going to be my next question. And then asset type. I know you mentioned, you know, the horror story of the 60 unit when you first got started, and you had mentioned that you mainly focus on A-, B-plus class properties. Maybe just give us just a brief synopsis of why that changed and what you are focused on today at this point.
Well, I've done enough 70s deals in my career now, and I don't need to do with them anymore. You know, it's like every career goes through an evolution. And, you know, when you survive that phase, you never go back. And so, you know, the first evolution is, you know, maybe doing fourplexes and 10 units. And, you know, once you've done your share of fourplexes and 10 units, and then you're doing 50 units, you're never going back and buying another fourplex. And then after you do some 50 units and 60 units and 75 units, then you, if you survive that, then you start doing, you know, 100 and 150 units. And once you're doing 150 unit deals, you don't go back and buy a 50 unit. And so, you know, now we've been buying, you know, the smallest we would buy is, you know, 100, but really 150 is small for us. You know, we'd rather be 150 or larger. And so we've been sticking to that. But, you know, we would buy a variety of vintages, but then after a while you've done your share of 60s and 70s deals, and then you just don't do them anymore. And so now, you know, we're doing, you know, 80s sometimes, but really 90s and newer, and preferably 2000s and newer.
Okay. Makes sense. So let's shift gears slightly and let's just talk about the state of the market for people just for reference, you know, we're talking the end of June here. We've just gone through some tremendous rate hikes, June 2022, just for reference. The whole, you know, real estate world has sort of been flipped on its head. And from what I can see, there's this disconnect between what sellers still are expecting and what buyers are able to make pencil. And so it seems like there's going to be a lull in transactions that are taking place. But I'm interested to just get your level or your thoughts at a high level about where we're at in the market and where you see things going.
Well, hasn't the bid-ask spread been around since the beginning of time? I mean, I would imagine even back when you were trading goats, I mean, you probably thought that a goat was worth more chickens than the buyer wanted to trade for.
Right.
I think it's the same thing now, you know, where there's always been a bid-ask spread and eventually you get a meeting of the minds. Right now, I think some sellers would really wish it was February of 2022 because February was pretty darn good. But it's not. And some sellers understand that. And we're seeing some compression in that bid-ask spread, which is resulting in some price declines. We've been seeing deals. We had one that was sent to us the other day. I think the pricing guidance originally was $200 million. And the highest offer that came in after marketing, it was $155 million. And so that's a big bid ask spread, but the seller was actually willing to make a deal. So of course, you know, they wanted to know if we wanted to get into the mix. And I'm like, you mean you want me to outbid your highest bidder? No, thanks. We'll wait. Call me when it's 135 million and then we'll have something to talk about. So we're starting to see, sellers giving in and transacting. So I think most likely you'll see price declines in the 10 to 15% range from where things were back in February to where they are now. And I think when they come down another 10%-ish, and maybe even more, maybe another 15, then we'll probably have some good deals coming our way. And I think it very well may get there. Now, even though we've seen a 10 to 15% decline from February, that there's really no decline since last June, because there was a huge run up in price from, you know, probably August of last year through February of this year. And, you know, that's when prices ran up 20% in the course of a couple of months. And I mean, we have a property right now we're closing on in a couple of days that we bought for $32 million that we're selling for $56 million, and it's only been like 20 months. And most of that run-up has happened, you know, it happened in the last 6 to 8 months. So that kind of stuff is over. We have to get back to reality and pay for real estate what it's really worth.
Yeah. And so who do you think are the sellers in this market climate that we're in?
Well, right now, the sellers are still people who are trying to harvest their gains. Mm-hmm. They're people who bought 2 or 3 years ago and the price is still substantially higher than 2 or 3 years ago. They might have bought even 3 or 4 years ago and had a 10-year price projection that today's price is probably still in excess of their 10-year exit value. And so they're like, hey, you know, why not get out now? Market's going to be rough for a while. Let's just, you know, harvest the gain and do some profit taking. And then we'll wait it out and get back in the market when the timing is right. That's today's seller. The seller that I think I want to see is the one that's the seller because their loan is maturing and no one's going to refinance them out. And they don't qualify for an extension and, they have to sell. When we start seeing those sellers, that's when we'll know that we're getting close to the bottom.
Mm. And how do you expect, and I know you caught the tail end of the previous recession, weren't as heavy into multifamily at that point in time as obviously you are today. How do you see banks reacting to loans that are maturing? Do you see workouts happening or do you feel like they'll come in heavy handed and force sales? What do you expect to see from lenders?
Oh, I expect to see them to be extraordinarily uncooperative, even though it can be to their own detriment. It just really depends. You know, if the value of the real estate is still equal to the loan amount, you know, they're going to want to see that disposed of and get paid back. If the value of the real estate is less than the loan amount, then the lenders are going to be panicking and they're probably going to be discount selling their loans to someone else who is going to now have real estate that's worth the new loan amount, or at least what they paid for the loan. And they're going to want to see that sold so that they can recoup their investment. So I don't see banks as being, or any lender for that matter, being extraordinarily cooperative and wanting to do a lot of workouts. You know, certainly there may be some if they see a path, but I don't think they're going to be all that helpful.
And you've very great timing, sold 2,500 units. Obviously you saw some writing on the wall and you guys took some pretty, it sounds like drastic action, not drastic, just opportunistic action to sell off close to a 2/3 of your portfolio. You still have between 500 and 1,000 units. What are you going to focus on moving forward? Are you still saying, hey, multifamily is my space and my focus, I'm going to stay here? Or do you look into other asset types?
No, it's times like this that we've actually done our best work. You know, the greatest opportunities are born out of chaos and dislocation in the markets. And, you know, we've been pretty good more often than not at taking advantage of those various opportunities. And so right now we're not buying much. In fact, we're not buying anything. We did buy $150 million three property portfolio in December from a seller that was kind of panic selling. So we got a really good deal on it. And so, you know, that actually comprises the bulk of our current portfolio. So we still like multifamily and we're still going to stick with it. And I think the fundamentals are still there. What's happening right now is just a variety of things that are taking some of the emotional premium out of multifamily. And that's really what a lot of this price run-up has been, has been emotional premium. I got to get my capital deployed and prices are running away and rent growth is out of control. And I got to have a piece of it. And the fear of missing out and all that other stuff has been driving a substantial price increase. And now what we're seeing is pricing coming back down to like a fundamental reality. And that actually works pretty well for us.
Yeah, makes sense. If I had to press you, and maybe you don't even, you know, maybe you have your blinders completely on and you're never tempted to, you know, look at other opportunities. But if I had to press you and you couldn't buy multifamily, you only had to buy another asset type, what would that be?
Probably airline tickets to faraway vacation spots, you know, that kind of thing. I would probably rather do nothing. I've done all the other asset types. I've done commercial, I've done hospitality, I've done self-storage, I've done land development. I've been in this business a long, long time. And what I've found is that multifamily is what I'm best at. And so that actually has been working out pretty well. And so right now I'm doing two things. In addition to our multifamily company, I also have a bridge lending business. At least I do for a couple more days, and then we're selling that company too. And so I think that experience has led me to a new opportunity of buying debt. So I might be buying some debt rather than buying assets. So that might keep me busy for a while. And then you know, the multi will come around. So if I had to pick another asset class, I'd say it would probably be debt.
Got it. And for someone like you who has had an incredible career, a vast amount of experience, obviously you've sold a significant portfolio at an incredible time. What keeps you motivated to move forward?
I just like doing this, and I'm not really good at a lot of other things. So, you know, I could never start up a business building widgets because I don't know anything about that industry. And so I think I was born to do this and I enjoy doing it. And it's not even work for me, really. I mean, sometimes it is, but I mean, really, I like it. So that keeps me motivated. I just like doing it.
Yeah. Well, and you've been a part of educating others. Obviously, there's a benefit to your business, but you wrote a phenomenal book that a lot of people are aware of. And talk to us a little bit about sort of your mindset about writing that book, The Hands-Off Investor. Tell us a little bit about that process and why you decided to go down that path.
Yeah, The Hands-Off Investor was written to teach passive investors how to properly invest in passive real estate syndication opportunities. And this came about by a couple of different things. One was I had a friend of mine that invested in a passive real estate syndication that wasn't one that I was doing. And she subsequently lost her entire life savings. So instead of, you know, kind of being set for life, she's literally like, you know, driving for Uber to like pay bills and put food on the table. So that was a really heartbreaking experience to witness. And I think, you know, what it came down to is she just didn't know what to look for and what to look out for that matter. And no fault of her own, because as I subsequently discovered in doing enough research on this, there really wasn't a resource out there for people to learn what to watch out for and that sort of thing. So that was the second catalyst to writing the book was, you know, just in talking with accredited investors, you know, that call us to want to invest with us. You know, accredited investors means you think that they know everything they need there is to know about investing. But yet I could tell by the questions they were asking me, they had no idea what they were doing. And so, again, no fault of their own. There's been no one there to kind of guide them and lead them the way to show them this is what you need to ask. This is what, you know, they should be telling you and that sort of thing. So I decided somebody needs to create this resource. And at first I thought it really needed to be someone that was a passive investor. You know, you'd think that a book written for passive investors should be written by a passive investor saying, look, this is what I do and here's how I've been successful. So I almost didn't write the book, but then I thought, you know what? I'm the perfect person to write this because I've been doing this long enough that I know where all the bodies are buried. And, you know, I can show everyone what that is and actually show them, whereas a passive investor might not know what they don't know, and that would get left out. So I've gotten some great response by people saying it's helped them out a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, tremendous book, The Hands-Off Investor, An Insider's Guide to Investing in Passive Real Estate Syndication. So you can grab that. I believe you have an Audible version as well, right?
It is on Audible, and it's also available through the publisher directly at biggerpockets.com/syndication book, or you can get it on Amazon bookstores or whatever.
Okay, great. Well, I want to start winding down here. I appreciate the time that you've spent with us today. You've been a wealth of knowledge, and it's great to get some insight from someone like you that has a tremendous amount of experience. A few final questions for you. The first is, what's the biggest challenge that you're facing right now in your business that we could all learn from?
The biggest challenge is that I'm having a lot of difficulty finding real estate that works, that the numbers work, where we can actually buy. So that's probably one challenge. I say the second biggest challenge is finding good employees. Now, on the capital side of the business, we're pretty well set. I think my newest employee has been here 10 years. But on the operations side, you know, the property management side, where you have, you know, a lot more turnover, and if you add a property to your portfolio, you've got to staff it up. It's difficult to hire on-site managers, maintenance people, all that sort of stuff. This labor shortage is real, and it's just difficult to get really good help. And that's probably, you know, people asking what the biggest risk in real estate is. Right now, the biggest risk is the inability to locate, you know, the labor resources, you know, really good labor resources that you need to run your properties.
And what's something that you're just absolutely knocking out of the park right now in your business that we could learn from?
Timing. I think selling
I meant to say that you weren't allowed to say selling your 2,500 units. So put that aside. That's in the past. What are you doing right now that you're crushing in your business that we could learn from?
You know, that's the only thing we're doing right now is selling. That's probably about, you know, I think we're crushing it from the standpoint that, you know, we've we've got a great base of investors, thousands of investors that invest with us, and we can raise a lot of capital in a very short time, quite easily. And so, you know, our ability to respond to the market when it's time for us to buy, we've got the ability to raise that capital and be able to build this portfolio right back up. So I would say that having a good loyal following of happy investors and having done this for over 20 years and never losing even a dime of anyone's principal, that to me is crushing it. And that's really why we're even here and in this business.
Yeah, absolutely. As it relates, just another side question before I let you go. As it relates to the capital raising, you recently acquired that portfolio. And, you know, I don't know the exact timing. I don't think you just said the exact timing on that. But did you see any lull in the capital raising? Obviously, you're able to raise what you need to accomplish the goals. But did you see a drop in investor appetite for deals? Or maybe you bought that property before things started to shift?
Yeah, it was just before the shift. It was December of last year, December of 2021. So it was right before kind of all the interest rate increases. But no, there was no difficulty raising for that at all. We had to raise, I don't know, 50 or 55 million. And I think it took us a couple weeks.
Yeah. Oh, I've noticed as I've just been observing offerings come through that you haven't seen as many, hey, fully subscribed in 48 hours as you did before the rate hike. And all of a sudden people are sending out the follow-up email, a little bit room left, a little bit more room left. And so it seems in my experience and what I'm observing that there's definitely a change in appetite from the investors out there. So having a good quality base that you've built over the 30 years is incredibly valuable.
Well, rightfully so. Anything that anybody's putting out right now is probably something they locked up in contract in, you know, at a time when prices were higher than they should have been. And those offerings are probably right to be seen with a little bit of a skepticism.
Yeah. Makes sense. Well, look, this has been a wonderful conversation. I appreciate you coming on and sharing some insights with us. Before we let you go, what's the best way for our listeners to connect with you and learn more about what you guys have going on?
Best way is through our website at praxcap.com. It's praxcap.com. You can also follow me on Instagram at Investor Brian Burke.
Love it. Well, Brian, thank you for your time today. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, and I look forward to staying in touch down the road.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me here.
Hey, before you go, if you and I haven't connected yet, please head on over to canovocapital.com. You can join our investor network or download our free passive investor's guide to multifamily syndications. Either way, I'd love to connect with you personally. Also, I just want to thank you for listening to the show and providing feedback and reviews. If you haven't already, please, please, please take a second and leave us a rating and written review. This helps us to be found by new listeners and helps us attract great guests in the future. Thanks again for listening to the show, and I hope you have a great day.